Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of the first session from our Becoming Buddha Foundations of Mindfulness and Meditation Spring 2018 retreat at One Dharma Center on May 17, 2018. My talk in our Sangha discussion is on the Nagara Sutta and the Loka Sutta. In the Nagara Sutta, the Buddha tells of his awakening experience and the clear path for all to awaken. The Loka Sutta describes his view of the condition of the world, then and now, and what must be done to leave the world behind. Information on our future retreats is available at becoming-buddha.com. All of these talks are based on the suttas included in my book, Becoming Buddha, Becoming Awakened. If you find benefit from this recording, and to support future recordings, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.
Welcome, everyone. As most of you have been on retreats with me before, and you know that I can get a little emotional. It's just marvelous to be here. It's just such a perfect place to experience what I think are the most important teachings that have ever been given to mankind. And what we're going to experience this weekend is very similar to the original Sangha, meaning that the setting is just like that. We are focused, we're together as a Sangha. The teachings, what you're going to hear this weekend, are the words of the Buddha. They're not the words of John Haspel. You'll hear my commentary on that and my understanding to hope to thrash it out and make it more accessible. But I really take that role, and it, to me it's such a profound thing to do, and I'm so fortunate to have you allow me to be your teacher. But to be in the role of presenting that authentic Dhamma has become the most important thing in my life. And so I consider myself very fortunate to have a vehicle to do that. So thank you all, sincerely.
Thank you.
So in keeping that in mind, creating this environment that is, again, very similar to the first Sangha, is so important because an awakened human being set up that first Sangha. And those of you that have come to the classes for the last 4 weeks, they were geared towards how he taught the Dhamma, in his own words too. The things that he avoided, the things that he thought were irrelevant, and the things that he emphasized. And then the most important emphasis that the Buddha ever gave is on the three marks of existence, on noticing the impermanence of all things, the arising and passing away of all phenomena, and the personal experience of suffering that results from not understanding impermanence, the five clinging aggregates. Anatta is the same thing, karma you could call that, all part of that same soup of a personal experience of suffering, which is what the Buddha awakened to. And then he spent the last 45 years of his life teaching other human beings how they could do exactly what he did, to become a rightly self-awakened one. I'm going to stop the introduction now and just go over some logistics, but I wanted to kind of get that out and lay the foundation. In the booklet that you have, please read it. Take some time to read if you haven't already, because the words are just absolutely brilliant, but the words are useful, and they set the tone for our retreat. Similar to what I just said. A few logistical things, if I can remember them. I can't remember the things that I wanted to say. Lauren is going to be the kitchen whip. She's going to be asking you a few people after each meal to help clean up in the kitchen. They requested that of us, but we've always done that anyway. But that's Lauren's job, and she's going to be very good at it. I want to thank David for being our timekeeper. Which really is one of the most important jobs, because he'll get us here on time. And David, welcome to your first retreat, and Becky, welcome to your first retreat. Again, you'll read this in the book, but a retreat is a time to immerse ourselves in the teachings of an awakened human being, and doing that while leaving the world behind. So the whole point of the Dhamma is to get to the point where we're no longer attached to the things of the world. And a retreat that I hope is properly run does just that. It instructs us in a way and creates the environment where we can leave the world behind. So beginning right now, leave the world behind as best you can. All of us have concerns that are tied to the world outside of here. And it's unreasonable to say, well, you're never going to have a thought about your kids or your home or your job or anything like that. But when it comes up, just realize where you are, and it's not something you need to deal with right now. The world will still be here on Monday. If you utilize this retreat to the best of your ability and wholeheartedly engage in what you're going to hear this weekend, you will be quite different come Monday. And those of us that have been on retreat, you know, can attest to that, I think. You know, these teachings and your incredible teacher you know I'm kidding when I say that, I hope.
It's true, though.
An auspicious, yeah, you might say this often too, this is an auspicious time for every one of us. We have an opportunity over the next 4 days to completely change the way we relate to ourselves and the world around us. It's remarkable. And there's nothing all that terribly difficult about it, except we have to be willing to recognize that maybe the way I looked at the world for a long, long time no longer really fits with reality. And we have a framework to develop that. That's called an Eightfold Path. There were some logistical things that I just can't think of them right now.
You're not
going to
go away,
are you? Oh, one was a schedule. I'd like to, and this is up to you. If you'd rather keep the morning meditation at 7, that's fine. But I'd like to make it 6:45 to 7:15, because really breakfast is supposed to start at 7:30. So we're kind of shortchanging ourselves. But again, if as a group you'd rather start at 7, and Matt's going to be leading, so 6:45 is okay?
We could do that, that's fine. Or we could just do a 20-minute sit from 7 to 7:20. That should give us enough time to walk over in time for breakfast at 7:30.
Is that good? Okay, so 7 to 7:20. So, David, you'll sound the muck tuck at 7:45? Okay. If there's anything that you need, it's important for me to do what I'm doing, but it's also important for me to make sure that this is as pleasant and peaceful a time as it can be. So if there's anything you need, or something about the facility, or even the pacing in our schedule, please let me know, or let Lauren or Matt know. Their Juan Dharma Center is incredibly accommodating, so if there's something you need, just let us know, we'll get it. Please try to get to our sessions on time when you hear the muck tuck, because as you know, those that have been here before, I do try to cover an awful lot of material. We're going to spend more time this weekend on two particular suttas, the Satipatthana Sutta and the Anapanasati Sutta. I may leave out some of the other talks and put more time into these two suttas. You remember that over the last summer, we spent about 15 weeks going over just those two suttas, so there's a lot there, but we'll condense it. There's an addendum booklet that has those other two suttas. We'll probably conclude Sunday with the Kulasekaka Sutta, too. I just think we just did that Tuesday night, but that's a sutta where the Buddha really puts the focus on the Dhammas. I think it's a nice way to end the retreat. So, any questions or comments? So that leads to one other thing. If you have any questions, certainly during a session, please ask, because what all of you have found is that our Sangha discussions and how we talk about what we're learning is as important, and I really feel this way, it's as important as what you might hear out of my mouth or hearing the Buddha's words, because it brings our Sangha together, and it creates what is so important and what is so rare in the world is a well-focused Sangha, meaning focused on the Buddha's Dhamma. All of you have made such remarkable progress in developing what the Buddha taught. And I think you all know me. I'm not given to hyperbole. If I say it, it's because I mean it. It may not be right, but from my point of view, I do mean it. I've been around the Buddhist game for a long, long time. And for what has developed in Frenchtown is really remarkable. I've never been part of a Sangha that is this well focused on just what the Buddha taught. And this is exactly what Matt and I, when we first met, we had a little lunch over down at the Bridge Cafe. And we immediately knew that we were on the same page as far as what we would hope to create here in Frenchtown. And it's a few years later, it's really remarkable what has developed. We're going to meditate first, I think. I'd rather meditate now rather than later. We've had a long day. And then I'm going to touch on three suttas tonight, but really just to lay the context and the foundation for what we're going to do. Hopefully I won't get into a lot of commentary on them, but you never know what's going to come out of my mouth. But I think we'll get through those and it won't be too late of a night. And again, the whole point of how I structure this and what I hope to teach is to present as complete a context of what the Buddha taught in a few short days. Because as you know, the context of the Dhamma is, we need that if we're going to actually develop it. One sutta here, one sutta there, just doesn't do it. And again, I've talked about this before. The reason, those of you that have been on silent retreats, I don't think anybody here would wonder, but the reason why I don't run silent retreats is I don't think there's any usefulness of developing the Dhamma there. If you're not mindfully engaged in right speech, how do you develop right speech? So that's one of the most important aspects of our weekend here, is keep the framework of the Eightfold Path in mind. And when you're engaged in conversation, whether it's during a session or walking around, be mindful of right speech and try to employ that. And this is a perfect opportunity to learn how powerful that can be by being mindful of right speech. So, okay, let's meditate first. We'll meditate for 30 minutes. There will be callbacks every 10 minutes, not every 5 minutes. This is what we usually do on retreat. So, find your relaxed meditation posture. Gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. Give me a minute to bring it up. You know what? I'm going to ask you to let me start you again, because I want to include this in the broadcast. So give me just a moment. I will be streaming these sessions if it works out, and then there'll be a record of it too that we can refer to in the future. Okay, just for the camera, just let me introduce ourselves again. So this is the beginning session of our 2018 Becoming Buddha Spring Retreat. And we are going to meditate first for 30 minutes, and then we'll have a talk and discussion. So find your relaxed meditation posture. Gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And now is the time to meditate. Holding your back straight, but not stiff. Your ears aligned with your shoulders, your nose aligned with your navel. And holding yourself softly, gently, lovingly. Allow yourselves to settle into this room, settle onto your seats, settle into your bodies, and settle into your minds. Notice the sensation of breathing in your body. Become mindful of your inhalation and your exhalation, your in-breath and your out-breath. While remaining mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath, notice that feelings arise and thoughts are flowing. We are sensitive and conscious beings. Feelings arise and thoughts flow. The purpose of meditation is to increase concentration and not be distracted by the arising and passing away of feelings and thoughts. Notice the arising and passing away of your breath in your body. When you find that you're caught up in your thinking again, simply acknowledge the distraction and return mindfulness to your breathing. Relaxing your thoughts, remaining mindful of the arising and passing away of your breath in your body. And we'll continue to meditate for 30 minutes with callbacks every 10 minutes. Our meditation session has been edited out. Guided Shamatha Vipassana meditations of various lengths are available at becoming-buddha.com. Kevin, welcome. Glad you made it.
Thank you.
I apologize for
No, nothing to apologize for. You likely won't awaken this weekend like the rest of us, but you'll get close. I'm glad you're here, Kevin. Wait, was something? It's important things that I need to pass on to come into my head and out, so. The effects of aging. One thing I didn't mention, if any of you want to have a one-on-one with me, just let me know and we'll find the time to do it. You know, the formal term for that is darshan, but there's nothing formal about it. We'll have a nice chat, though. So again, put yourself in that position of the first sangha. These folks heard of this incredibly brilliant awakened man and came from all over northern India and southern Nepal to hear what he had to say. And we're going to hear those words tonight. We're going to begin with the Buddha's description of his awakening. And then we're going to get into the suttas that describe becoming. I'm not going to read much of the introductions because it's in the book. Did everybody bring your copy of the book, Becoming Buddha? So if you want to read that, and I encourage you to read the introductions, we don't need to go over it. The introduction in the Nagara Sutta places a lot of emphasis on explaining what the Bodhisatta or Bodhisattva ideal is and the difference between that path and what the Buddha taught. And the real significance of that is that the Buddha always referred to himself prior to his awakening as an unawakened Bodhisattva. So what that means, and the Buddha was not putting down what a bodhisattva means. He was just simply pointing out the difference between a human being who is imbued with great compassion, but lacking the wisdom of Four Noble Truths. And that's what the Buddha means when he says, when I was an unawakened bodhisattva. Once he awakened, and the significant thing about the Buddha's life when you look at it, is the Buddha, while he was part of his father's kingdom, was in a position to be of great service to human beings. He had the power, he had the means, the financial wherewithal, but he knew that that wasn't an answer. And so he left that life behind and began a life of very strict austerities, thinking that that would give him some understanding. That was a common belief during the Buddha's time, and it's still a common belief today. There's still entire practices that are rooted around severe austerities. There's also practices that you might not even notice as a very severe ascetic type practice. But to me, and this is getting to why we don't have silent retreats, to me, a denial of any one of our senses is a severe and ascetic practice. And there's no way to understand the Dhamma unless we're fully engaged within the Dhamma. So we don't do that. We have an opportunity now, just like the Buddha Sangha, to be mindful of the Eightfold Path and let that Eightfold Path guide our thoughts, words, and deeds on this retreat. So in the Nagara Sutta, the Buddha was at Savatthi at Jita's Grove. And I'll ask not Evelyn Wood to remind me if I'm speaking to you. Does anybody know who Evelyn Wood is? I'm probably the only person in this room that does. Yeah. Evelyn Wood made it, I think it was a man actually that was behind it all, but he made millions of teaching speed reading. Yes. And unfortunately I studied that when I was younger, and that conditioning has not worn off yet. So Lorna will remind me. The Buddha was at Savatthi at Jita's Grove, Anathapindika's monastery. There he addressed those gathered. Friends, before my awakening, when I was only an unawakened bodhisattva, or bodhisattva, I came to the realization of the difficulties of the world. The world is born, it ages, it dies. It falls away and returns. But there is no understanding of the ending of stress and of suffering, and the suffering of aging and death. There's no understanding. The Buddha is now describing his awakening, and he's putting in the context what's important to understand. We have lives, and if you want to believe in endless lifetimes, we have endless lives. We arise and we pass away, just like the world arises and passes away. And in all of those lives, in all of those cycles of the world arising and passing away, we never address the key issue of stress. Worlds arise and pass away without gaining any understanding of what the Buddha awakened to. And then he says, describing his awakening, the thought process he was going to, When will the world understand the cessation of stress and suffering from aging and death? Now he's talking about physical aging and death, but he's also talking about the constant reinforcement of ignorance in our own mind. So the true meaning, and by the way, next week I'll be talking about emptiness because I think it fits. The true meaning of how the Buddha used the term emptiness was to empty ourselves of clinging and empty ourselves of ignorance. That's the emptiness that we're striving for. And that's a direct job that we do on ourselves. We empty ourselves of our ignorance, literally. As we find it arising, we recognize it and we put it aside. And that's how we empty ourselves. And we need a well-concentrated mind and we need the refined mindfulness of the Eightfold Path to see that happening. When will the world understand the cessation of stress and suffering from aging and death? Then I had the thought, what initiates aging and death? What is the requisite condition that aging and death are dependent on for arising? Now he's talking about dependent origination. From my appropriate mindfulness, such an important line, appropriate mindfulness. The Buddha's not talking about just being mindful. Appropriate mindfulness. What is he talking about? It's mindfulness that is focused in a way that can see the arising and passing away of all phenomena. Appropriate mindfulness. From my appropriate mindfulness came a breakthrough of understanding. From birth as the requisite condition comes aging and death. From birth as the requisite condition comes aging and death. So how can we avoid getting born? The Buddha teaches. Then I had the thought, what initiates birth? What is the requisite condition that birth is dependent on for arising? From my appropriate mindfulness, there's that line again. We're going to learn more about appropriate mindfulness through the Satipatthana and the Anapanasati Sutta. From my appropriate mindfulness came a breakthrough of understanding. From becoming, and in my translation of this, in parentheses is the word ignorant. From becoming ignorant, remember that word is in parentheses, as the requisite condition comes birth. From ignorance. Now the Buddha is in a tangential way talking about physical birth, but in the context of the Dhamma, it's ignorance giving birth to what? Another ignorant moment. From my appropriate mindfulness came a breakthrough of understanding. From becoming ignorant as a requisite condition comes birth of another moment rooted in ignorance. And this is what we all, from our own conditioned thinking, rooted in ignorance, is what we give birth to. And as we develop the Dhamma, we can recognize and have a direct experience of that process. We know that we're doing it. And when we know that we're doing it, when we can see it arising and passing away within ourselves, then we can bring it to cessation. And nothing else, I can't see it, it's bad enough about it. Can't hardly see it without the glasses. From that single understanding of our own contributions to stress because of our minds rooted in ignorance of four simple but noble truths, we create all the suffering in our lives. And if you want to believe in one life to the next life to the next life, that's what we're giving birth to in each moment. But the important understanding, and we may or may not get to karma and rebirth on this retreat, to understand about that is not what I might be born as in some future life. The Buddha wasn't concerned about it, that at all. What am I giving birth to in this moment? And now remember, this is the Buddha describing his own awakening process, and he's describing it in such detail that we can integrate this whole process in ourselves. We can see this same awakening process through the framework of the Eightfold Path. That's why he taught the path, to have the same exact experience. Okay, I'm passing over a little bit of my commentary. The Buddha continues, then I had the thought, wait a minute, I think I skipped over too much. No, I didn't. I just have to put this in context. In the 12 links of dependent origination, there's a reference to nama-rupa, or name and form. I think it's the third or fourth link. Nama-rupa is the Pali word. Name and form is what it means. And it simply means that I have now identified myself with this form. I've given this form a name. This is John. And once I've done that, once I've established in my mind that this is myself, and it's a permanent and fixed self, then I'm compelled to continually defend and maintain this self. And it's that initial wrong view, name and form, this is me, that continues that whole process rooted in ignorance. Then I had the thought, what initiates name and form? Another word for name and form is self-referential views. What initiates name and form? What is the requisite condition that name and form is dependent on for arising? From my appropriate mindfulness came a breakthrough of understanding. From consciousness as a requisite condition comes name and form. Now remember, the Buddha isn't leaving us in the dark about what he means by consciousness. He's referenced it earlier. It's consciousness rooted in ignorance. So it's not some grand cosmic consciousness. It's not a consciousness with a big C. The consciousness that the Buddha is referring to in this sense is ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance. From my appropriate mindfulness came a breakthrough of understanding. From consciousness as a requisite condition comes name and form. From thinking rooted in ignorance comes self-referential views, comes self-identification. Is that clear?
Mm-hmm.
Again, this sutta is a key to understanding the whole Dhamma because it's included in here. And I didn't come across, this is the sutta that should be put out there. Everybody has to read this first. Because it was many years studying the Sutta Pitaka that I came across the Nagara Sutta. And it floored me. It literally took me weeks just to integrate what was presented here because it's so profound and so deep. And like any of the Buddha's teachings, it's in the overall context of dependent origination and Four Noble Truths. But this is a sutta that we can all awaken on if we get it. We don't have to. But this is one of the most profound suttas that the Buddha ever gave. Skipping forward a little bit. Then I had the thought, what initiates consciousness? What is a requisite condition that consciousness is dependent on for arising? From my appropriate mindfulness came a breakthrough of understanding. From name and form as a requisite condition comes consciousness. Now, wait a minute. Didn't he just say consciousness begins getting name and form? And now he's saying, wait a minute, it's name and form that starts consciousness, that initiates consciousness. Sounds pretty confusing from an awakened human being, isn't it? What he's describing is the feedback loop that we all get caught up in. Once we start identifying ourselves as this is me, and our mind is now rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, every thought that we have is a self-referential thought. In other words, every thought that we put out there is bouncing back as a reference to ourselves. I like this, I don't like that. I want this, I need this. I don't want this, I don't want any of it. It all initiates in this feedback loop of consciousness reflecting on what I think I am. And remember, what I think I am is rooted in ignorance. I don't know what I am. That's the Buddha's meaning when he used the term anatta. Again, one of the most misunderstood terms. The Buddha used that a common word during his time that was used to say there's no such thing as a self, but he used it only as a convenience to point out the wrong thinking in that word. The Buddha used the term anatta to say what you think of yourself does not constitute a self. Those views do not constitute a self. They're not a self. They're anatta. That's what the Buddha is describing here. Then I had the thought, this consciousness turns back at name and form and goes no further. It's the same as saying it turns back on itself and gets stuck there. It goes no further. And so unless there's something that intervenes to shake that mind loose, it'll spend eternity looking back at itself and reinforcing those views. Is that clear? Is it? It is to this extent, this is so important, it is to this extent that there is birth, aging, death, falling away, and returning. To this extent, we must be caught in the feedback loop to initiate the process that keeps us stuck in the feedback loop. And so as in a physical world, in order to continue that, it's required to have a physical experience of it, isn't it? We are not a mind separated from the body, we are a mind immersed in the body. And that's how we have the experience of ignorance. But it's also the key to getting out of that. Because it's not by escaping our body and our mind that we free ourselves, it's by understanding that this body and this mind is united in the process of becoming constantly. And then the question is, what am I going to become? And that's the question we should ask ourselves in each and every moment, and not to the point of distraction. But what am I becoming now? What are we becoming this weekend? Who wants to answer that? Somebody. Yeah. And that's our choice. That's our choice in this moment, throughout this weekend, but even, and obviously going further. But it's the choice that we have in each moment. This is why a well-concentrated mind is required. That's why the Buddha taught meditation. And it's why the refined mindfulness that's framed by the Eightfold Path is required, so that we can be fully present for this process of becoming. And as we initiate this process and our minds are still rooted in ignorance, we can recognize ignorance. How can we do that? Because now we have a framework. It's why the Buddha taught an Eightfold Path. If it was just a mind rooted in ignorance, has no way of recognizing its ignorance. A mind that is deluded would not know that it's deluded. How would it? And the Buddha describes why we can't, because we're stuck in that feedback loop. Something has to intervene to break that loop, to break that constant feedback loop of self-referential views that are constantly reinforcing wrong views. How do we do it? Luckily, we have a way of doing that. I'm going to go back one line, because then the Buddha is now going to point out how all of this process leads to the problem of what he described in dependent origination. It is to this extent that there is birth, aging, death, falling away, and returning. And by the way, we have that same experience, that falling away of returning, and this is why Samatha Vipassana meditation is taught the way it is. When we are noticing the arising and passing away of our breath in our body, we are noticing that entire phenomena of all phenomena arising and passing away. It's both metaphor for what's occurring, and it's a direct experience. And isn't that incredible that an awakened human being was able to combine something that is both metaphor and a practical experience?
Can you say that again? That just ran right over me. I missed it.
The it's so hard for me to remember. the act of meditating, yeah, noticing the arising and passing away of the breath in our body, is a direct experience of the arising and passing away of all phenomena. Mm-hmm. And in that way, that deepening concentration, every time that we find that we're caught up in our thoughts again and come back to the sensation of breathing, that's all that meditation, it's the only meditation, the method that Buddha ever taught, because it's powerful enough to break the chain of ignorance.
Okay.
And every time we do that, it may seem, it may seem insignificant when we do it, and it should seem insignificant. We shouldn't overemphasize it, because then we get too fixated on, oh, the present moment. But every time we find that we're caught up in our thinking again and come back to the sensation of breathing, we're interrupting our own ignorance.
Yeah.
And off our cushion, we can now take that recognition of the arising and passing away of phenomena and apply it in a practical way to the arising and passing away of conflict in our lives, or something else that's distracting us. I always say winning the lottery or having a nice piece of chocolate cake. If we maintain that level of mindfulness and notice the arising and passing away of all things, beginning with meditation, we are able to interrupt this process. And again, this is why the holistic, the unified Eightfold Path must be engaged when as it's taught. In other words, when we start to adapt and accommodate or embellish the Eightfold Path, or dismiss it, which is often done, we're dismissing an awakened human being's teaching. There's nothing left then. I don't mean to always be making a commentary on modern Buddhism, but it's important to point out the difference. The Buddha taught a simple and direct Eightfold Path to recognize this process of continual eye-making, the being stuck in that feedback loop. There's no other way out of it because we're stuck in it, and we don't even realize it until we have something that shows that to us. I got to go back once more, and hopefully I won't comment again on this. It is to this extent that there is birth, aging, death, falling away, and returning. This is what I wanted, the whole point I'm leading up to. This is where ignorance is established. This is where ignorance is established. It is to this extent that there is birth, aging, death, falling away, returning. This is where ignorance is established. In that feedback loop. Name and form, meaning self-referential views, is the requisite condition that brings consciousness, and consciousness is a requisite condition that brings name and form. This is where ignorance is established. Name and form is the requisite condition. Self-referential views is the requisite condition that brings consciousness, and consciousness is a requisite condition that brings name and form. Another way of saying that is thinking rooted in ignorance is the requisite condition that brings name and form. Self-referential views feeds on wrong views, and wrong views is supported by self-referential views. Then I had the thought, the sixth sense base, meaning the five physical senses in that ongoing thinking, consciousness, rooted in ignorance, is dependent on the condition of name and form, dependent on self-referential views. This is the origination of the entire mass of suffering. Has everybody followed me to this point? It's not all that complicated, is it? And we can see this process in ourselves. And we can also see it, and we had an interesting conversation. When you start understanding it, sometimes it's easier to see this ignorance in its grossest forms in other people. But as we develop a more subtle understanding of ourselves, we see it in ourselves constantly. We see the arising and the passing away of ignorance. Yes.
So is he saying that before we got the consciousness and we were little babies and we touched something or tasted something, before we had the reference of ourselves, we were just experiencing it without any referential views? If you go back far enough in our lives.
No. No, you can't go back far enough. And the fact that the Buddha gives many teachings on that, there's no beginning to this.
Okay.
There's no beginning to this. It seems reasonable that I'm a little baby and I haven't been influenced by it yet.
Right.
And okay, we'll go back there. But there's no point that you can say, aha, ignorance began. The only thing we can know is the cessation of it. Mm-hmm. And this is why going back into past lives isn't.
Actually, going back into past life is useful here because that is the beginning.
Well, but to recognize that this is a continual process and we need to extricate ourselves
and
from it.
It's driven by the ignorance from the previous lifetime. You fall directly into the ignorance of your current lifetime.
Yes, and the Buddha did not put much emphasis on that. What he was concerned about is the ignorance that we have. It doesn't matter where ignorance, this is the best way to say it. It doesn't matter where ignorance began, I'm ignorant.
Yeah.
And I'm suffering because of it.
Yeah.
That's the
because if you think about trying to figure out the beginning is the same as trying to put blame on why I feel bad. That person did this to me, so I feel this way. It's the same thing.
Yeah.
It's the same thing as what Vachagoda was doing. It's still trying to find a self-reference to phenomena that's just arising and passing away. And by the way, ignorance is part of those phenomena that arises and passes away continually. It is the ongoing stress that we're just realizing how debilitating stress is to our health. That is the underlying stress. It's the continual maintenance of ignorance that literally destroys ourselves. It takes some people a little bit longer than others. But we now know that the underlying cause of many medical conditions is stress. And we don't even realize it. Why? Because we're ignorant of it. It's an aspect of ignorance to create these very powerful, and it's the more I see this, the more profound it is, the extent of ignorance and how ignorance requires continual ignorance of its own ignorance to continue. It sounds crazy, doesn't it? But those are the scenarios. That's I making. I do things so that I can ignore my own ignorance. And in doing so, I create tremendous ongoing stress in my life, whether I realize it or not. Now, I might have been created the type of life where I don't have to even notice it. In other words, I might have set myself up as a powerful person or a very wealthy person or a situation where I can just lay along on a beach forever. And so I never have to really recognize the suffering that I've done, that I'm in, and the scenario that I created, so I don't have to recognize it. But we all do that on very subtle levels until we find a way, something shakes us loose enough to say, you better look at this. What's wrong with my life? Me. But not in a way that we should blame ourselves, because that's just self-referential. What's wrong in my life is ignorance. But ignorance of what? It's not a general ignorance. None of us are ignorant people. The Buddha never said that human beings are ignorant. He taught that we are ignorant of the way things truly are, though. Four Noble Truths.
So the Eightfold Path is allowing you to see how you're hardwired.
That's a good way, yes. And seeing it directly and having a direct experience.
When it was a good idea to be a caveman running away from something in the dark, that doesn't really exist anymore. But that caveman didn't have any way to deal with that world he was creating to protect himself when there was really nothing there.
Yes. Yeah. Would someone please turn the light on just so I can see a little better? And it probably seems plenty bright for you in here, but is that okay?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. I think it was our first retreat, and it was our friend Kevin, not Kevin that's here. I think it was him that brought this up. I was talking more about the not-self characteristic, and so when we first hear that, it sounds like annihilation. So what's going to happen to me if there's no such thing, and I'm not, there's no self here? And the question was put, well, what happens if you're walking on the train tracks and a train is coming at you? And the implication in the question was, well, there's no such thing as a self, and I shouldn't be concerned about me, that you just let the train hit you? That's foolish. And in fact, if that happened, there's no opportunity for awakening, is there? You're gone. So the answer, when you're standing on the train tracks and a train is coming at you, take two steps to the right. Makes sense, doesn't it? Instead of standing here saying, I believe in the Dhamma. What good did it do you? That's annihilation, isn't it? Those kind of thoughts. So there's a reasonable fear that we should all have that's part of preserving ourselves so that we can awaken. When the train's coming at you, get out of the way. But sometimes, and we don't know when a train's coming at you, look at poor Bahia. The cow got him right after he awakened, but luckily he awakened. We don't know. There's a usefulness to understanding our environment. But as the Buddha teaches, fear is stress. And a mind that is rooted in ignorance is in constant fear. We don't recognize it, but another word for that constant fear is stress, because I need to maintain myself. And I'm afraid that I won't be able to. Or I'm afraid that I won't have the things that I need to maintain myself. And again, that's that underlying stress that gnaws at all of us. But it's also, we have here this weekend and in these teachings a way to recognize it and simply let it go. Simply abandon it. Let me finish this up. We may not get to the other sutras tonight. But,
well, you just skipped to the next thing, which is that the sixth sense base.
Yes, that's
where it starts.
Yes, then I had the thought, the sixth sense base, is dependent on the condition of name and form, dependent on self-referential views. This is the origination of the entire mass of suffering. So what's the Buddha pointing out? It's through this ongoing consciousness rooted in ignorance that we're now interpreting things coming through our physical senses. We're physical beings. And if that interpretation is rooted in ignorance, the resulting perceptions and assumptions that are made from that, fabrications, are themselves rooted in ignorance. They can only reflect ignorance. They can only reinforce ignorance. And we're using our physical senses, including that consciousness, to continually reinforce name and form and consciousness. We're stuck in the feedback loop. And it is through these senses that we continue to reinforce it. But our senses are not the enemy. They're simply the vehicle that ignorance is using to continue its own ignorance. It's at that point of contact that it's so important to, that's why I say, in each moment, it's an opportunity to become awakened if we're able to practice restraint through concentration. I'm sorry, Matt.
No, that's, in that way, these phenomena of physiological processes like breathing, sight, hearing, all of those things are functioning without any self-referential necessity. There's no me required to see something, hear something, smell something, taste something, touch something. But yet, it becomes my sight, what I saw, what I heard,
because of name and form, because exactly. You've identified this exactly. Is me, so these are my eyes, and I like that, or I right. Don't like that, or whatever.
So if three people are sitting here meditating, and they hear those birds, each one of us may have a different experience.
Oh, yeah.
Whether it be pleasant, not pleasant, or neutral.
Exactly.
And you do start noticing that more and more as you develop your mindfulness.
Yes, but three people could have that, but one person could have that same experience of pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, and almost simultaneously.
And not cling to, this is my, I need this pleasant sound.
Well, you could. At one moment, the bird is pleasant. But then you're getting a little distracted. That damn bird, why doesn't it shut up? In the same body, in the same mind, in the same experience. And we do it, we've all had that experience that at times we like something or someone, and other times nothing's really changed, but we can't stand that person or that situation or the bird. And why is that? It's because our minds are jumping from sensory input to sensory input. And because they're interpreted by ignorance within an impermanent environment, there's nothing stable. So we can't even count on a beautiful bird song being a beautiful bird song the next moment. Why? It's not because the bird changed.
Right.
It's because our perception of the moment changed. And again, in that moment, if we've had enough of meditation, then that bird singing is not going to be an aid to our meditation. It's going to be the reason why we can't meditate. You see?
Mm-hmm.
So think of the ramifications of that. There's no safety then anywhere, is there?
Yeah.
Except in understanding. And it's in understanding the ever-changing nature of the bird call that we're able to understand the ever-changing nature of everything, including the ever-changing nature of our minds. And then when we can truly be present, an awakened human being's mind is not fixed at any point. It's a completely malleable mind that sees things from appropriate right view, from my appropriate mindfulness. The thought came to me. What's occurring right now, Laura and I had a little talk about this before too. Awakening doesn't mean that we have no feeling. It means we have intense feelings, moment by moment, that are not distracting and are entirely appropriate for what's occurring. Yeah, isn't it? It's amazing, but it's the secret. It's not the secret to life. It is life. We can't have life unless we're present for it, can we? If not, we're living a dream in our own minds, which is really what we're doing. And that's another word for stress. It's another word for not living in truth, for a noble truth, but living in a deluded state of mind. The three defilements of greed, aversion, and deluded thinking. You could put those all together into deluded thinking. But that's what we're describing here. But we're also describing a process of recognizing it and abandoning it. And developing a mind that is at peace no matter what birds are singing or what aren't singing or whatever is occurring. And it's a mind that is non-discriminating from the self-referential point of view, which is why everything is okay. Because I don't need it to be any different anymore. I'm no longer identified as something that has to rule my world. I'm simply in a process of becoming. And I'm at peace with what's becoming because there's no me in it. Isn't that remarkable?
Mm-hmm.
And isn't it remarkable that a human being was able to figure this out on his own? I sure couldn't do it. But then he took the time, the last 45 years, an awakened human being could have just said, man, I got it, I'm good to go. But he had that compassion. Remember, he was an unawakened bodhisattva before he got this. He wanted to help people, but he never saw himself as a savior. And he knew that this was not a salvific thing that he was teaching. He knew the work that individuals had to put into it. But he spent the last 45 years of his life teaching anyone that would listen. And to me, the most remarkable thing, you've heard me say this over and over again, is those teachings are still present today, and his words, you've just heard them, and you're going to continue to hear them. Was there a question?
Yeah, yes, I have a question. So I can't remember how he says it, but in the very beginning when he's asking the question about aging and death and suffering, and how the Dhamma is, I don't want to call it an escape from aging, but it's a, he calls it something, release from aging.
Yeah, release is the word.
Release from, so if there's no me in the past and there's no me in the future, that's how you escape.
Yeah, and if you really understand that.
There's no continuation to call aging. And no future to be considering death in. So that's just not.
Never born, never died.
Yeah.
That's
so,
the death. That's what. When the Buddha talks about the deathless state, that's what he's talking about. He's not talking about living forever.
Yeah. I get it now.
That is. Yeah. Well, you get it. You're good to go. Thank you. This is what I mean about a well-focused sangha, because you said it in a way that everybody else could understand it.
No,
seriously, this is how this works. This is the deathless state. The deathless state means I don't give a damn about death anymore because I'm here. And
I'm not there yet.
I'm getting closer, but I'm not there yet. And even the more profound understanding is that transition from a physical life to whatever is of no concern. It's not something, going to the four teachings that we just went through at Cross River Meditation Center, it doesn't matter. Because I'm alive. And when I'm dead, I'm dead.
And on a more just day-to-day thing, you just can exist at that present moment much easier.
At the highest level possible for human beings. Yeah. Really, that's what the Buddha's teaching.
Well, I just feel like ignorance is this little circle of feedback, and then there's all this other space that is just being ignored.
Yeah, that's it. We are literally ignoring our own life through ignorance.
Saying, yeah.
And it is just, it's not just a little bit. There's nothing there.
Yeah.
Ignorance is I'll make the point that I made a little earlier because maybe it'll make a little more sense now. Ignorance takes constant, vigilant attention to maintain, because impermanence says that if we would let go of ignorance, it's gone, and it ain't coming back. Listen to my English. It's not coming back, unless the conditions are there to support it. And where are the conditions? They're in my own mind. They're not out there. They're not a part of the world. No matter how, this is something that comes up often that. If the Buddha was alive today, he'd teach something different because the world is so different. The world isn't different at all. We have, it's much, the possibility for destruction is much more immediate. But the underlying cause is exactly the same as it was 2,600 years ago. Ignorance. And then we could say, well, then we got to stop ignorance everywhere. We can't. If an awakened human being didn't try to do it, because he knew that was fruitless, it was foolish, it was, that thought is rooted in ignorance, what can we do? We can end it in ourselves. And of course, my foolish dream is if enough people would do it, then we really could end ignorance on this planet. Honestly, I don't know that that's ever going to happen, but that's not the point. And in fact, it sounds, to most people, it would sound like, isn't that so important? It's not. Because the Buddha described the world as dukkha.
Yes, the first moment.
And it's always going to be dukkha. It cannot and it does not have to be any different. But within that, the world of suffering, we can be compassionate, you know, to be dramatic, we can be compassionate beams of light like the Buddha was. He didn't wake up, he's describing it here in the Nagara Sutta. He woke up, now I have to get to the Loka Sutta because it kind of caps this. But he saw that the inherent and inescapable suffering in the world. And he didn't say, F it. He said, I know how to end that. I know how to change our thinking so that we don't have to be caught up in the suffering of the world. It's still there. there's still sickness, aging, and death in each and every one of us, no matter where our thinking process is. We are still subject to not getting what we want and getting things that we don't want. This is how the Buddha describes suffering. But if there's no me there, it doesn't matter. Then I'm just in the process of experiencing this. And I can tell you that the most remarkable thing that I have learned about my life is to be in it. Now, most of you know my history. I spent the first 212 years of my life trying to not be in it in every way possible, including gallons of vodka every day and pounds of pot and ounces of cocaine and a little bit of junk put in. And none of it got me out of it. I'd wake up the next day and, damn it, I'm still here. I'm still stuck in this. I need another drink, or I need another argument, or I need more TV, or another round of golf, or more exercise, or more food, or more sex, or more this, or more that. A self-referential ego self is insatiable. And it's insatiable because it needs to keep maintaining itself. And it maintains itself through what? Through objects, events, views, and ideas. It becomes so enamored with its own thought process and the things that it acquires that it cannot let them go because it's all that it has. And so whether you're someone like me that found true happiness in the bottom of a vodka bottle, I'm kidding, and identified with that, or you're someone who found true happiness in having the greatest career in the world or the most power in the world, you're stuck in ignorance, no matter what the experience of it is. How do you get out of it? An Eightfold Path. It's the most gentle path we can put ourselves through. Was it me and Lorna talking on the way up? Awakening is the most gentle thing we can do. It seems harsh at first, but the most harsh thing we can do is to maintain ignorance because we're maintaining dukkha. Mm. It's up to us. I want to get through this, but this is maybe I'll finish tomorrow. I don't want to rush through it either. So there's some more, some of my comments in here that are good to read, but I'm not going to, but you may later. So then the Buddha continues. He's describing how he awakened. And this, pay attention because this is how we are going to awaken, either tonight or tomorrow. Kevin's going to have to wait.
You got a refund?
I think Kevin's closer than any of us. So the Buddha's words, he's describing his awakening. Vision arose, understanding arose, knowledge arose. These are things that we want to acquire. And you use the word escape. It's okay to say escaping suffering, you know, because that's what we're doing. The Buddha's describing his awakening process. Now, vision arose, meaning he's seeing things clearly. Vision arose is the same as saying I acquired right view. Vision arose, understanding arose, discernment arose, knowledge arose, illuminating insight arose within me with regards to things never known before. This is another one of my kind of key points. It's often said that the Buddha just discovered a path that has always been here. Well, listen to his words. These are things never heard before. Then I had the thought, what is the condition that cessation of stress, of aging, of death is dependent on? From my appropriate mindfulness, I love that line, came a breakthrough of understanding. From the cessation of the birth, my words, of ignorance. But remember that that's the context that the Buddha's teaching. The idea of becoming, it often didn't have a modifier or a qualifier. It was just left as becoming. But we have to know the context. So the Buddha's talking about ignorance here. From the cessation of the birth of ignorance as the requisite condition comes the cessation of the stress of aging and death. From the end of ignorance. The Buddha awakened to dependent origination, which states from ignorance of 12 observable causative links, all manner of suffering arises. And then he taught Four Noble Truths to explain that process, the result, dukkha occurs, and how to end that process. Excuse me, the Eightfold Path. From my appropriate mindfulness came a breakthrough of understanding from the cessation of consciousness, thinking rooted in ignorance as a requisite condition, comes the cessation of name and form. So both of the ends of that feedback loop or the container for that feedback loop fall away when we recognize and abandon ignorance. It is ignorance that is required to maintain this feedback loop of continued ignorance, which is simply another way of saying we create these great strategies, these powerful strategies to ignore our own ignorance. That's the feedback loop. That's this thing that we put ourselves in, and we get so caught up in it, and we're so deluded that we think that this feedback loop is life. But Jen just pointed out, this feedback loop is nothing. It's just, it literally is. The Buddha never said that the world is an illusion, even though sometimes that's ascribed to him. He said that it's like an illusion, and that's a very significant difference. Because if it's an illusion, nothing really matters, does it? But it's like an illusion, and we're the magicians. We're playing the trick on ourselves, because of our own, from that self-referential feedback loop. The world is like an illusion, and we're the magicians. We're playing the trick on ourselves. But the great thing about that is we can stop playing the game. From my appropriate mindfulness came a breakthrough of understanding. From the cessation of name and form, as a requisite condition, comes the cessation of consciousness. I have attained this path to awakening. From the cessation of name and form comes the cessation of consciousness. From the cessation of consciousness comes the cessation of name and form. From the cessation of name and form comes the cessation of the sixth sense base. So it certainly doesn't mean that awakening, we no longer have senses, does it? All we have to do is look at an awakened human being, and he didn't lose his senses. We stop using our senses in an ignorant way that causes suffering. Remember, the context of what the Buddha is talking about is bringing ignorance to cessation. From the cessation of the sixth sense base comes the cessation of contact. And again, it doesn't mean that we lose the ability to feel or have contact with the outside world. We simply stop using that contact to reinforce ignorance. From the cessation of contact comes the cessation of feeling. It doesn't mean that we stop feeling. But remember, and we'll get into this more in the suttas tomorrow, we use feelings to reinforce name and form, don't we? But from the cessation of ignorance, we stop using feeling, I'm feeling this way and you're to blame for it, to continue to reinforce these ignorant views. Comes the cessation of feeling giving rise to further ignorant views. And that's the context that we must remember. From the cessation of feeling comes the cessation of craving. When I no longer need to feel any different than what's occurring, then I won't crave for anything, will I? I certainly won't need a gallon of vodka to change the way I feel, because I'm not craving to be anything different than I am right now. I am at peace with who I am and what's occurring in my life, the cessation of craving. And at its most deep and profound, it's not craving for a bottle of vodka or a piece of chocolate cake. It's craving for more self-referential views. That's the ultimate thing that we're letting go of. Because that really is, and you could refine that all the way down to being enamored with our thoughts, because that's really what drives all of this. We so love the thoughts that we've used to create this life that's like an illusion, that we can't let go of it. We can't let go of the magician's tricks. From the cessation of craving comes the cessation of clinging or maintenance. Clinging and maintenance is often taught together, because clinging is maintaining ignorant views. We cling ourselves, we attach ourselves. The Buddha often talked about suffering as we join with our suffering. And we literally do that, don't we? Mm-hmm. We become one with our suffering. And once we do that, another word for name and form, five clinging aggregates, once we do that, we are stuck in a feedback loop. There's no way to get out of it unless we have a way of recognizing what we're in. From the cessation of clinging and maintenance comes the cessation of becoming. Remember, from the cessation of clinging and maintaining comes the cessation of becoming further ignorant. From the cessation of becoming further ignorant comes the cessation of the birth, meaning if we can talk about it in physical terms, but what is most important comes the cessation of the birth of ignorance. We've now taken this process back to its original causation, even though it's not recognizable, and it's unimportant where it began, because now we've brought it to cessation. And it doesn't matter if we've been stuck in ignorance for 62 years and 9 months, or 62 million years, 62 eons. What's the word that's often used in... It starts with a K. It doesn't matter. There's a word that means a lot of eons, but I can't think of it right now.
Kalpas.
Endless kalpas. Which kalpas is, it's described like, I can't, it's too mind-bending for even me. My mind is pretty bent, but it doesn't matter how long we've been wandering in samsara. Samsara is another word for wandering around in ignorance. Because now I'm awakened. There's no past. It's almost like, but not entirely like, it never occurred. But it never occurred. It's not a part of me anymore. All of the, and nobody in this world can escape life without feeling trauma. Some of it is much worse than others. But simply having a human life, the five clinging aggregates, is traumatic. And it conditions us. But we can leave that all behind with one thought. What's the thought? I'm not going to answer that. What's the thought? From the cessation of birth, then aging and death, sorrow, regret, pain, distress, and despair all cease. It's not just physical birth, remember. From the cessation of the birth of ignorance, then aging and death, and again, the Buddha's not saying, he's referring now to the reaction to aging and death. I'm worried about getting old. I don't want to get old. I don't want to die. And we do all kinds of things, don't we, to try to put that off. And it's a good idea. I'm not saying we shouldn't take care of ourselves physically. That's an important part of the Dhamma. But not to the point where we insist that we have to live forever or we create scenarios where we're afraid of death because it's going to happen. How can we have a human life right now if we're not at peace with the fact that at some point we're going to meet the cow like Bahia did? And a true understanding of death, a realistic understanding of death, would help us focus our Dhamma practice. Because like Bahia, there's a lot of cows out there. We have an opportunity over the next few days to beat the cow. From the cessation of birth and aging and death, sorrow, regret, pain, distress, and despair all cease. This is the cessation of the entire mass of stress. Then the Buddha says again, vision arose, understanding arose, discernment arose, knowledge arose, illuminating insight arose within me with regard to things never known before. In this way, I saw a timeless path. And this is where people get confused with a pre-existing Eightfold Path. The Buddha is simply referring to a timeless path, not going into the past, but a timeless path that is applicable throughout time. In other words, it was good a zillion years ago, and it's also good in 2018. It's a timeless path.
Because the world hasn't changed.
Because the dukkha occurs. That's the problem. That's the description of the world. And so in the Dhamma, we talk about literally leaving the world behind, just like we're doing on retreat. That's why I started the retreat that way. We are creating a situation that allows us to experience what it's like to leave the world behind and yet be fully immersed in the world. When the Buddha awakened, he touched the ground. And he said, I have left the world behind. For me, there will be no further rebirths. What he was saying, most importantly, was there's nothing left inside of this awakened human being to give birth to another moment rooted in ignorance. For me, there will be no more further rebirths. But he's also saying that he ain't coming back anymore. He's done. Another way that he says it is he's put down the burden. He often referred to the burden of wrong views as just that. It's a burden that we carry around with us. We can put down the burden. There's a book that's related more to recovery from alcoholism and drug addiction. The book is called Put Down the Rock. Some of you might have read it. That's what Buddha's referring to. We carry this rock on our back, this burden of wrong views. And it literally sucks the life out of us. And many of us, we know young people today that seem like they're exhausted already because of the burden they're carrying around. We all do it, but we don't have to. And we have a way of putting down the burden, of dropping the rock. And it's through an Eightfold Path that any human being can engage with. And certainly we are. In this way, I saw a timeless path to be traveled by rightly self-awakened one. We do it ourselves. And what is this timeless path traveled by what rightly self-awakened one? What is it?
Noble Eightfold.
Just this noble Eightfold Path. Right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation. Can you all do that? Can you engage with right view and right intention? Right speech, action, livelihood?
Mm-hmm.
Right effort?
Mm-hmm. Not constantly, though, but I can do it.
If you can do it,
yeah.
One thing that we, as human beings, if we can do something once, we can do it over and over and over again. We never lose the capability of doing something. And the Buddha taught a path for human beings to develop. Human beings with all their ignorance and all their insistence on continued ignorance could develop this path. How do we know? Because he did it, and he taught so many others. But in this room, each and every one of us has had the experience of the practical benefits of this path. There's nothing magical or mystical about it, except it's, to me, it's the most miraculous thing ever taught. But it's practically miraculous, isn't it? Because it works. It gets us out of it. This is a timeless path traveled by rightly self-awakened one. I followed this path. I followed, Buddha's saying, I followed this path that I'm teaching you. Following it, I came to direct knowledge of the stress of aging and death. Following it, I came to direct knowledge of the origination of the stress of aging and death. Following it, I came to direct knowledge of the cessation. He's referring to the Noble Truth here too. Do you see it? This is referring to the third noble truth. Cessation of dukkha is possible. Following it, I came to direct knowledge of the cessation of stress of aging and death. Following it, I came to direct knowledge of the path leading to the cessation of stress. Following it, I came to direct knowledge of birth, of becoming, of clinging, of craving, of feeling, of contact, of the sixth sense base, of name and form, and of consciousness. By saying that, he's saying, this is what you will understand too. He says, you will come to this knowledge, to this understanding. Following it, I came to direct knowledge of the origination of consciousness. The direct knowledge of the origination of my thinking rooted in ignorance. This is what he's teaching. This is what we're developing. We get to have the direct experience of where it began in our own mind, not at a physical point in time. And this is why it's so important to have a mind united with a body, because a mind that's not united with its body has no reference point. And so then we see what a mind united with its body in the continual process of becoming awakened is. It's simply a reference point to what's occurring. And it's an ever-changing reference point if we are well concentrated in. If we are well concentrated enough, then we can unify and keep our minds unified in our body where our life is occurring. A mind that is not unified in its body is stuck in the past or stuck in tomorrow. Or it might be just a minute ago or a minute in the future. But a mind that is not united in its body is never present, and it can't be present. By definition, obviously, it can't be present. So the Buddha's whole teaching could be said to be that, a way of uniting the mind and the body without any self-referential views. What an incredible thing. Yeah. To be here and not care from an acquisitory way what I'm getting out of it. I'm at peace with what's occurring. In that way, life is its own reward. And life is the only reward. And think about that. What have we been given? We've been given, despite dukkha, we've been given a human life. However it came from, we have it. Whether we've been giving it, or we acquired it, or we just find ourselves in it. But the most important thing is, what are we going to do with it? Well, what's most important to have once we have this thing, once we find ourselves in this physical life? Wake up! It's the only thing that's of true, real value. Now, of course, along the way, we all have responsibilities. We have families to take care of, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that doesn't mean that unless we're inclined to do that, that we should walk away from our responsibilities. But we can bring this understanding into our mundane lives and live like Anathapindika lived, or King Ashoka, fully awakened beings, but fully engaged with the world. And in Anathapindika's way, in commerce, he continued to keep his business going. King Ashoka awakened, and he continued to rule India during that period of time, about 350 years after the Buddha's death. I'm getting a little bit off the point here. Following, I came to direct knowledge of the cessation of consciousness. So of course, he's not talking about not thinking anymore. Consciousness rooted in ignorance. Following it, I came to direct knowledge of the Eightfold Path leading to the cessation of consciousness, leading to the cessation of thinking rooted in ignorance. That's why the Buddha taught an Eightfold Path. Following it, I came to direct knowledge of fabrications. Fabrications are assumptions we make rooted in ignorance. Following it, I came to direct knowledge of the origination of fabrications, of assumptions. Following it, I came to direct knowledge of the cessation of fabrications. Following this path, I came to direct knowledge of the path leading to the cessation of all fabrications. Imagine not having any fabrications in your mind. No, you don't have any assumptions left about who you are in relation to the world. That's a liberated mind. That's a mind that's truly free. And it's a mind that is truly free within its own body, without a self-reference to the body. Do you see? Following it, I came to direct knowledge of the Eightfold Path leading to the cessation of fabrications. Knowing the Eightfold Path directly. Now remember, the Buddha is describing his own awakening so that we can follow that. Knowing the Eightfold Path directly, I have revealed it to monks, to nuns, to male lay followers, and female lay followers. And in most of the translations, he goes on and talks about the different non-physical realms that he revealed it to. And honestly, the more I look at that, I realize that he was referring to that because that was a common belief of his time, and just trying to bring that into the Dhamma. But he always referenced that in a way as there's nothing superior about non-physical existence. It's all the same aspect of dukkha. There's nothing to aspire to there. And that's what he was pointing out to the common belief that we live this life to get to a non-physical existence where everything is wonderful, or hopefully it is. The Buddha is pointing that out, that that's just as prone to dukkha as this physical life. And he's not giving it any validity by talking to it. He's just referencing it because it's a common belief of his time. I teach an Eightfold Path so that this path becomes powerful, rich, detailed, well-populated, widespread, and proclaimed by all wise beings. Thank you, all wise beings. We're not done yet, though. Oh. I have 15 minutes. So give me a little. There's more to that if you want to read it, but I think I made the point there. Let me do it this way. This is from the Loka Sutta. I might not do the other one, unless you're with me. It's about 9:15. Have we got another half hour in you? If you've had enough, you've had enough.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's see how far we get. But this is you see, obviously it's a continuation of that. This was probably taught much later, but the newly awakened Siddhartha, now a Buddha, was enjoying the peace of release. Established in concentration, he observed the world around him. And notice how he could be describing 2018. He noticed human beings aflame with a fire is born of the defilements of passion, aversion, and deluded thinking or deluded consciousness. Realizing the significance of what he was seeing, he thought, the world is aflame. Rooted in ignorance, the world is afflicted by sensory contact and perceives suffering as self. We've joined with our suffering. Rooted in ignorance, it misunderstands self and becomes anything other than self. I'll explain that later if it needs. I think the sutta will explain that, becoming anything other than self. Becoming anything other than self, the world clings to becoming. Becoming anything other than self is creating a self rooted in ignorance. And so now we've created this name and form. Where's my glasses so I can see it? We've created something that is other than a self that is in a constant process of becoming, aren't we? We've created something that is other than self, a fixed self, a self that is now rooted in self-referential view. That's what he's referring to. Becoming anything other than self, the world clings to becoming. Right? We are now clinging to or insisting on maintaining ignorance, becoming further ignorant. It's the only way we can maintain that wrong view. And as Jen pointed out, it's a powerful but ultimately completely insignificant or insubstantial view. There's no real substance behind it except the substance that we give it by clinging and maintaining. The world clings to becoming, is afflicted by becoming, and yet delights in that very becoming. Where there is delight, there is fear. This is what I was referring to. Why is where there's delight, there's fear? Why?
Because it might end.
Because it might end. Once I become delighted with myself and my situation, I'm afraid I'm going to lose it. Mm-hmm. Because it's all that I have. It's all that I am. I need it. And especially when I create an identity over the things that I have acquired, whether it's a view, an idea, or an actual object, or a person. We've all heard that phrase that we take hostages in relationships. Well, that's what that means. Because we so join with our suffering and attach ourselves to it. We literally become one with our suffering in that way through our attachments. Where there is delight, there is fear. Where there is fear, there is stress. Dukkha occurs. Delight is, in this sense, it's ongoing eye-making. And anything we do from that point that we are delighted in, fear follows, and from that fear follows stress. It's inescapable. And this is a process that's almost, you can almost say that it's outside of time. In other words, it's not progressive. Delight, fear, stress. It's all happening right now. From that initial point of eye-making. The life integrated with the Eightfold Path is lived for the abandonment of becoming. Now again, remember the context. I'll put it in that context. The life integrated with the Eightfold Path is lived for the abandoning of becoming further ignorant. Simple and clear and direct, and you really could say, how much more powerful statement could any human being give you? A life integrated with the Eightfold Path is lived for the abandoning of becoming further ignorant. The whole point is to recognize and abandon ignorance. Those that say that escape from becoming is by becoming, meaning continuing the process, are never released from becoming. That feedback loop. And he says, then I declare, those that say that escape from becoming is by non-becoming, meaning annihilation, which is another common belief that after death, and this is still a common belief today, there were those that during the Buddhist time that taught a materialistic or a humanistic, which is how it's often referred to, meaning that we have this one life, there's nothing else, and so you might as well just make the most of whatever you get. It doesn't matter how immoral or moral, what you get, what you do to get that, it's this one life, so there's nothing to worry about, do whatever you want. Well, the Buddha's saying, and that's the belief in also non-becoming, that there's no result, there's no karma to my actions. And of course, the Buddha is not really concerned about what might happen in a future life, but we cannot non-become in this life. We will directly have the experience of our wrong views in this life. There's no escape from it in that way. That's the true meaning of karma. It's not punishment, it's because of what we've set in motion in our own lives and in our own minds. Those that say that escape from becoming is by non-becoming are never released from becoming, I declare. Stress, dukkha, arises in dependence on becoming self, meaning becoming a self-referential person. With the ending of clinging to self-referential views and maintaining self-referential views, no stress will arise. No stress will arise. That's what we've been talking about. Look at the world. Human beings afflicted with ignorance crave for and cling to becoming. All forms of becoming, anywhere, in any way, are impermanent, stressful, always subject to change. And this is where he's referring to a physical realm and a speculative non-physical realm. He's saying, even if, and not giving it credence, but there's no escape even there. The only escape is solving the problem of ignorance right here in this life. All forms of becoming anywhere in any way are impermanent, stressful, always subject to change. Knowing this, the arising and passing away from right view, craving for becoming and non-becoming is abandoned. From understanding the process of all things arising and passing away that we initially experience in meditation, the arising and passing away of our breath, and we're going to get more into this tomorrow when we get into the Paticca Samuppada Sutta, which is how the Buddha taught, the Satipatthana Sutta, the instruction on noticing first. The first thing the Buddha taught about meditation, the anchor or the cornerstone of his teaching, is notice the breath in your body. Immediately pointing us to the importance of recognizing the phenomenon. The phenomenon of all things arising and passing away. And it's experienced in meditation, and then it's through the Eightfold Path that we're able to hold that refined mindfulness to see it in all things that are arising and passing away. From the abandonment of craving for becoming and non-becoming comes unbinding. We are no longer joined with our stress anymore. We're no longer joined with suffering. We're no longer joined to ignorant views. That's what the Buddha means by unbinding. When he talks about an awakened human being, he describes that human being as released or unbound from clinging to wrong views. And he would also describe awakened profound right view as having a profound and penetrative understanding of dukkha. We understand the Four Noble Truths. That's the ultimate establishment of right view. For those unbound from lack of clinging and maintaining, there is no further becoming, further ignorant. They have conquered ignorance. They've completed the task and have gone beyond becoming a self-rooted in ignorance. That's the end of the sutta. And that's enough on, I think that sutta really puts those three suttas in the right context. We understand what becoming is. We understand what we have the choice about. And we know that the cows are out there. It's in this moment that we can awaken. But we have to be in this moment. We can't be in any other moment. Awakening doesn't occur yesterday or tomorrow. It doesn't occur outside our bodies. It occurs right here, right now. This is the most auspicious moment that we can ever live. Any questions or comments? Yeah, maybe that's enough, huh? That's a good start.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.